I want to start by welcoming you to this session, and I braved my way from Queens to the grad center just now through the rain, and it's very nice to be here inside when it's not wet and all these things. And with that note, I just want to give you a quick introduction to this panel, and hope to have more discussion later on. We'll keep some time for that. My job is to basically introduce the speakers, give you an idea what we are going to be doing, and facilitating the discussion in the end. My name is Professor Madhulika Khandelwal. I'm director of Asian American Center at Queens College, which is a research center, has been there for 20 years, and has been working with not only Asian Americans, but the diverse population, especially Queens, at Queens College. And I'm very happy that we have this panel today, new demographics, right? And I have been, not a demographer, but I have been dealing with demographics quite a bit of Asian Americans and the diverse populations, especially in our metropolitan areas. But generally what we do in that kind of study is look at the ethnic groups, the size of the population, race, ethnicity. Sometimes we talk about gender and those kind of things. But I think there are new ways of looking at demographics also. And I want to mention just a couple of things about that. One is that demographics for the study of what? Why do we want to know about demographics? Is very important. Not just getting the numbers, but why do we want to get the numbers? What are our questions that we want to pursue? What kind of inquiries we want to have? And in this context, I think it's very important to go into demographics and the new demographic trends when we are talking about a topic like Asian American women, so we can contextualize the topic itself. Secondly, there is a lot that's happening right now which cannot be put into very standard straight boxes of ethnicity and sometimes even of race. We can't do that anymore. Asian Americans, as you all know, are a very, very diverse group. In fact, there are major debates going on right now in the field about what are the boundaries of Asian America. Where do people become Asian Americans, and what makes them like, oh, we are not Asian Americans? You know, what is the boundary of Asian America? Is a subject of major debates right now in the field itself. And I think the panelists today will not only touch upon those things, but give you new ways of looking at it as well. And third thing I want to say about women as such, Asian American women, also a very diverse group. It's great to have a conference on Asian American women, but also to know that we are talking of a very diverse population. Women who are coming from different countries, to women who have been here for a considerable time, and also coming from very diverse cultures and societies. So it's very hard, I feel, to do a very stereotypical generalization of Asian American women. You know, we hear all kinds of things, like some people assume that Asian American women, Asian women, in fact, many people don't even use the word Asian American, they would say Asian women are docile, are this. You know, those kind of notions are there. And we are here to not challenge everything, but to say what is going on really in our communities. What is going on so that we can really question some of the stereotypes and really go into more debate about not only Asian American women, but the context in which they live, what kind of life they're shaping for themselves, and what kind of challenges they face, so on and so forth. So for me, the agency of Asian American women is also very important in this, and not just have them as subject matters in these debates, right? So with that quick introductory note, I want to present our speakers today. We will start with Justin Leroy, who's here. He is a graduate student at NYU and sent me a wonderful abstract about mixed races. You know, this whole thing about Asian Americans, as I said, it's very diverse, but also it crosses with so many racial identities and so on and so forth. And he is not only a scholar, but I understand he made a film on this topic itself. And he has a PowerPoint presentation, actually, all the articles I have today. So I will give Justin the floor, and to tell us about his work. And we'll do the same. I'll introduce the other speakers as they come along, and then we'll keep time for discussion at the end, question and answer at the end. Thank you so much, and talk to you again soon.
Fashion models and these images that are popping up in the past few years. But a warning is that I'm more of a literary person and I don't have a lot of empirical data for you. But the purpose of all of this is to get us to think about mixed race not as sort of a collection of individuals, but really more about different ideological stances. Because even though numbers in the demographics are going up, these kinds of people have actually existed for hundreds of years since, and you can take any kind of different kinds of national context, and inevitably mixed race children will come up. And so the fact that it's only being talked about in certain ways now, I think, is not so much a sign that there are so many more than there used to be, more that we're just using them in different news ways. So I'll just start off with a little bit of historical information. This past census in 2000 was the first time that people could check off more than one race box. And almost 7 million people did, which is about 2.5% of the population. And 1967 was when the Loving decision in the Supreme Court, which repealed anti-miscegenation laws, and which had been on the books for over 300 years, since almost 100 years before America actually became a country. So that tells you how important, keeping races from not sexually mixing was to sort of the constitutive nature of the U.S. and the nation. And there are a couple of ways that the image of the mixed race child is used to sort of scare people or draw them over to their side. Race mixing, the threat of race mixing has been the major justification for racial violence, from Lynching to Vincent Chin. I don't think this was in the documentary, but if you go back and look, the two men who beat him were actually very upset that he was sort of, they were at a strip club, and they were upset that he was sort of lusting after this white woman, and they suggested that maybe a black woman would be more appropriate for him. So that's certainly interesting part of the story. And of course, abolitionists used the image of the mulatta as a figure that was black but also had the humanity of a white woman and sort of gained sympathy for her cause. And it's also a question in terms of citizenship in the nation. You see, after the Vietnam War, I'm not sure if it's still ongoing, but there was a question of the citizenship of Amerasian children who were fathered by American servicemen. And so that becomes a question of the mother, the woman, the Asian woman's citizenship for constituting the identity of the child. And a lot of this all sort of came to a head about 15 years ago. There was this cover on Time magazine. So published the famous New Case of American Issues, which is this computer-generated mixed-race woman on the cover. And on the inside, there was this two-page spread where it was like a graph. You could chart different mixes based on, there was X, Y, and Z races on top and X, Y, and Z races on the side. And you could point to a meeting point, and it would give you the computer-generated face of any given mix. So that was kind of a disturbing aspect of the magazine. But I think what's more interesting is that this kind of image is being posited as this uniquely American and distinctly modern development, and it is used to allay anxieties over intermarriage and immigration. And Time even goes so far as to claim that America is the world's first multicultural society. Of course, ushered in by the woman on this cover, who they called Eve. And so images like Eve have become so popular, and you see boxes of Kashi cereal with interracial couples on the box. There's an increasing number of mixed-race fashion models. There's a commercial where children of all different colors shouted, "I am Tiger Woods." It's a Nike commercial. And so even though all these examples are very consumer-driven, I think more important is that they're all sort of touted as signs of social progress. And so the ways they sort of reinforce this world capitalist sort of hegemony go ignored. At the beginning of the 20th century, the Italian Marxist Antonio Gramsci wrote, while he was in prison, that the aim of the state is always that of creating new and higher types of civilization, of adapting the civilization and the morality of the broadest popular masses to the necessities of the continuous development of the economic apparatuses of production, hence of evolving even physically new types of humanity. And so even though time attempts to characterize these images as new, I think Gramsci's prediction really shows that even though these kinds of bodies always existed in a biological sense, they only emerge as sort of in public discourse at the moment when it becomes useful to the aims of the U.S. nation state. And even though all of these kinds of racial and cultural formations can be co-opted in the service of the state, like hip hop would be a great example of a form that started off kind of radical and then quickly became co-opted. But what's interesting about this practice as it relates to kind of rooting is the fact that in American public discourse around race, race mixing is sort of imagined as the end of race. And so the discourses around the end of race and the use of race for capitalism really come together around these kinds of mixed race bodies. And so I'm going to talk about two different kinds of future, and I use the words teleology and tautology. And teleology is just something that has an end point, you know, it's progressing towards an unlinear trajectory towards any given end. And tautology is sort of a circular argument that doesn't really provide any new information, no matter how long it goes on. And so it just goes around and around. It made me think of these past couple of months, there have been a lot of magazines with Barack Obama on the cover. One of them, U.S. News and World Report, was titled, "Does Race Still Matter?" And the other one that I saw was Rolling Stone, and the title was just Barack Obama and New Hope. So taken side by side, I think the magazine sort of articulates this contradiction in that it would seem that only by questioning the continued relevance of race as a social category can Obama and bodies like his democratize the future. There's a journal called Cultural Critique, and a couple of years ago they had an issue dedicated to the topic of posthumanism, and the editor asked, "How does one disentangle the critical potential of hybrid subjectivity from the corporate practice of producing hybrids so well suited to the needs of capitalism?" And I thought that was a really interesting question. But I think before we ask it, we have to determine what exactly the potential here in this field is. And so I would like to suggest that the potential of hybridity to resist co-optation by global capital and the state is, and then its inability to actually do so, to perpetually be caught up in images and narratives like we see on the Time magazine, is really about a problem with the way we conceive of racial hybridity. And so I just want to suggest that these kinds of images limit the kinds of, they're used not because we're actually afraid of mixed-race people overrunning the U.S. or whatever. It's more to sort of control the kinds of roles that other different kinds of differently raced people, monoracial people, if you will, can play. And so I think by thinking about mixed race differently, we can actually sort of open up the field for talking about, for example, Asian American women, who I think are particularly affected by these discourses. And so hybridity is mostly theorized through the lens of futurity, in that it always denotes progress. And so I use the word progress here only as a marker of time, not in a positive connotation. And so whether you subscribe to the liberal view that race has been a sort of sign that we're moving forward with regards to race and approaching an era when we're all the same color, or to the more conservative view that miscegenation signals the coming of these brown hordes that will endanger American whiteness, the phenomenon carries this particular connotation of moving forward in time towards a clearly defined endpoint. And so for the former, the future is simply a validation of the unquestioned global corporate practices taken to what is imagined to be their logical end. You know, everyone becomes sort of equal in this democratic globalization. We all go intermix. And then for the latter, the future has to be a never-ending rearticulation of the present in present conditions. Otherwise, society as we know it will come to an end. So the hybrid body is always sort of scaled into a temporality that ensures that it sustains these very, very sort of neoliberal problematic assumptions about race. And sort of, I think through these sort of twin narratives of teleology and tautology that keeps hybrid being meshed in that sort of circle. And so the hope and the fear that both of these kinds of narratives engender comes from the conceptualization of race that sort of understands it as ending once we all start mixing. And so it ignores the fact that different social inequalities will most likely be displaced onto other social markers such as class, color, education, language, accent. And so until we sort of begin to consider hybridity outside of that framework, I think we can't really gauge its potential, that this editor in a cultural critique alluded to. Here, these are some of the images of mixed race Asian Americans that I've found in magazines. They're oftentimes very sexualized, as many ads are. But I think they really only allow for certain futures and certain ends and certain trajectories. And I think it's particularly pernicious for Asian American women because it naturalizes certain discourses and then obscures others. For example, if you think about the huge population of children who came from military brides, by thinking about mixed race children as this purely celebratory thing, it obscures the violence that many Asian women experienced during wartime. And there's really no way of sort of using these mixed race children to talk about that kind of violence if we only think of them as individuals who are looking for wholeness and validation. And there's a series of dolls that sort of, they're called Real Kids, and the tagline is, I'm the perfect mixture of both, and my parents need me out of love. And also naturalizing certain sort of racial configurations. Japanese American women, I think, it's probably an old statistic, but 30% of Japanese American women marry outside that ethnic community. And so, again, if we think of this kind of image as the only way the future can progress, there's really no inroad to question that particular statistic. It sort of shuts off the dialogue surrounding it. Can we just skip ahead? Sure. There were two reality television shows the past few years that had mixed race Asian contestants, and the first is Manhunt, The Search for America's Most Gorgeous Male Model, and this man, John Johnson, won, who is a Thai and Icelandic. And then the second season of America's Next Top Model featured April Wilkner, who is Japanese and white. And so John was called Jungle Boy, Hawaiian Hottie, Keanu-esque, even though his body is sort of marked in many ways as white. And April's body is similarly marked, but her race is implied through photo shoots like this. And it's in fact only by drawing attention to the race with costumes like this and the comments that people made about John that we begin to see their race. And I think a lot of times the state ideology requires these images of the hybrid body to function as attempts to assimilate those bodies and disavow the significance of their race. But I think that racial difference always sort of slips beyond the containable borders of the body in potentially subversive ways. And so there's always a tension between assimilability and excess. So in the finale of Manhunt, one of the judges claims that John is so good looking it's almost too perfect. And even though his race and racial difference are not pointed to explicitly, they take shape in the sheer excess of such a statement. Tyra Banks said of April that, "We think you pose better than all the girls here, but modeling isn't about being mechanical, it's about emotionally connecting to the camera." And so that kind of criticism isn't really about any kind of racial lack, it's about this excess. She showed too much skin, offered too much input, thought too much, and ultimately was too robotic. And so, rather than affirming the universal nature of hybridity, John and April sort of disturb these racialized spaces that they exist within, and trouble the idea that all traces of race can be eliminated through mixing or assimilation or hybridity. And it's actually only in the ways that their bodies can't be described in properly racial language, they can't be quite categorized as one thing or another, that they are distinguished from the other contestants. And so even though hybridity has been sort of discursively formed for the purpose of containing difference, there's always sort of a surplus that remains outside and resists that kind of ideological formation that the Time magazine puts out there. And I think if we think about mixing and hybridity in that way, then we can sort of open up discourses surrounding Asian American, particularly as it relates to military and how marriage breaks.
Thank you, Justin. Sure, a lot of things happening, and hopefully we'll be able to talk about this a little bit after the speakers. So our next speaker is Kimberly McKee from Third Wave Foundation. And Kimberly is going to be talking about inter-country adoption. As you would notice, we are talking about new demographics, not just the demographics there. And Kimberly, while working on her master's degree, she examined this particular topic of inter-country adoption. And so this crossing of boundaries, this crossing of some of the very standard identities that we think, and in fact, both mixed race population and adoption, now that has been a phenomenon, significant phenomenon for quite some time, I would say historically actually. But it's very important that we pay attention to that, and they should not be lost in this emphasis on this exclusive ethnicity and those kind of things. So, Kim, you want to tell us about your work?
Sure. Thank you. Well, first I want to let you all know that my work today in this presentation is not reflective of the Third Wave Foundation. This is stemming from my own personal academic interest looking at country adoption. My interest lies in understanding the location of Asian transracial adoptees within Asian American discourse. They're commonly overlooked, and because the United States is actually one of the top receiving countries, accounting for half of the world's intercountry adoptions that occur around the world. I'm primarily interested in Korean adoptees, as South Korea has sent the highest numbers of adoptees. They've sent over 160,000 since they started at the end of the Korean War period. And up until they continued to be the leaders in inter-country adoption up until the 1990s when China finally surpassed South Korea. Moreover, not until the last decade of the 20th century did the gender of adoption shift from Korea, where now more boys are actually sent internationally than girls. which is why I'm actually interested in looking specifically at the identity formation of female Korean adoptees raised in transnational households. Unfortunately, I am going to be touching upon both post-colonial and queer theory, and I will probably not be giving these scholars their justice during this presentation. And I just want to preface that now. It's a bit difficult given the time constraints. Well, the first wave of intercountry adoption lasted from 1948 to 1953 and is characterized by the adoption of actually European war orphans, predominantly of German, Greek, and Italian descent, as well as orphans from Japan. However, following the first wave, the children who are adopted now are overwhelmingly originating from countries in the global south and transition countries. I use the term transition countries to discuss former U.S. countries in the USSR, as well as when we're talking about countries such as South Korea, which is emerging into and entering the developed world. And I use this slide to sort of show, looking at where Korea is placed in intercountry adoption as a sending country, as well as the ones that are in blue represent all of the so-called Asian countries. And it's something to be aware of when we're talking about, you know, where these children are going and how are they going to formulate their identity, especially when coming into a country like the United States, where predominantly most of the adoptive parents are white. So, you know, noting that an estimated 30,000 adoptees a year migrate from sending to receiving countries, when looking at the United States, unfortunately, this is the only statistic I have, that in 1987, the U.S. experienced foreign adoptees entering the country at a rate of one child every 48 minutes, which is really astounding. I don't think people ever realized how many children were coming into this country. Actually, South Korean adoptees formulate the largest population of this type of migration in the U.S. And over time, the original goal of humanitarian relief has been displaced, which has been creating this imbalance between sort of the global south versus western countries. This existing disparity invokes Spivak's notion of white men are saving brown women from brown men, and that humanitarian discourse allows westerners to become saviors of third world children. We've seen this when we're talking about now Angelina Jolie, when people are talking about Madonna more specifically, and what's happened with her and her son. I now want to draw attention to looking at Korea as a sending country. It's interesting because although the Korean government has already apologized to their intercountry adoptees for sending them away and how they've had numerous stances of actually trying to end their participatory role in intercountry adoption, they are still participating, though at a much lower rate. The beginnings of its Korea's participation are rooted in the fact that there was this need to find permanent homes for the multitude of children displaced in the post-Korean War period and the economic deprivation of the 1950s and 1960s. Overall, adopted Koreans make up approximately a third of the estimated 500,000 international adoption placements since the 1950s. From the end of the Korean War until 1981, U.S. citizens adopted an estimated 38,000 Korean children. Thus, in the context of the United States, when we look at Spivak's grammatical configuration concerning the saving of brown women, you know, intercountry adoption becomes the second option when, you know, healthy, predominantly white babies are not available, families are experiencing rejection from domestic agencies, and it remains an alternative to childlessness. The quest for a healthy baby, who, even though is not white, is usually not black, creates these racialized subjects. This adoption remains unlike the transracial domestic adoption of black children by white parents in the U.S. because the adoption of Korean children does not carry the historical baggage, even though there are other issues of wealth, power, race, deception, kidnapping, class exploitation, colonialism, and imperialism. The trope of humanitarianism as an international act positions the rights of an adoptee as unimportant because the adoptee doesn't fit perfectly into this existing black-white binary. Unraced from the beginning of their adoptive lives, adoptees are neither black nor white and consequently exist in the state of in-betweenness. You know, I'm sure we all know what the term Asian American means in this room. You know, we know that it sprung out of this whole rejection of this notion of what it means to be Oriental, because we're not Oriental. Or the Orient, as Said puts it, is the state in which the whole East is confined. Understanding this fluidity, it's interesting that you hardly ever hear much about Asian American adoptees in this discourse. So when talking about Asian American discourse, I draw upon the work of Foucault and looking at what he calls the regime of truth, which, drawing upon the fact that he knows that all knowledge, when applied to the real world, becomes true, and therefore the Foucauldian resistance that I think Asian American discourse is, it draws upon basically we're opposing this exclusionary nature of dominant discourse, which in finding the productive power produced by the dialogue between the truth and knowledge becoming questioned. Because we're questioning what, you know, Euro-Americans, white Americans are saying that we are as Asian Americans. Looking at discourse as a system of representation, we find that knowledge linked to power not only assumes authority of the truth, but has the power to make itself true. Therefore, the creation of a subversive Asian American identity enables an interrogation of this regime of truth. I draw upon that end quote because I think it's really helpful when understanding Asian American women and their identity formation. Because not only do Asian American women suffer the stereotypes of being characterized as model minorities or being characterized as sneaky, devilish, like Fu Manchu, they also are subjected to stereotypes of being this lotus blossom dragon lady that exists in the West, with depictions ranging from the overly aggressive, hypersexualized Lucy Liu caricature to the ultra-passive, China doll submissive. Asian American women are situated in this highly defined world where actions could be misinterpreted due to mainstream society's perceptions of what it means to be Asian American and an Asian American woman. When these stereotypes were challenged in Margaret Cho's short-lived sitcom, All American Girl, you saw critics lambasting the program, and viewers accused her of being both too ethnic and not ethnic enough. She was also considered too fat at times, questioning all these notions about, you know, Asian women are supposed to be these size 00 people, when we all know that's not true. Its cancellation after running about 7 months illustrates how dominant discourse is hesitant towards accepting a non-tokenized Asian American woman as neither drag lady nor lotus blossom. Stereotype depictions provide a visual to mainstream society, creating barriers for Asian American women when negotiating identity formation because of their visibility, which illustrates how Orientalist discourse forms Western perceptions of Asianness. Thus, media images, when taken out of context in conjunction with other stereotypes and representations, can reinforce Orientalist perspectives on Asian American women, as the depiction of women of Asian descent as Americans does not satisfy prevailing notions of what mainstream society perceives as Asian American. From here, I go on to try and locate the adoptee experience. And this is where I draw upon both queer theory and postcolonialism. I'm using Butler because Butler's meaning of queer as a point of departure remains useful in discussions concerning transracial Asian adoptees who remain marked by, for they are neither black nor white, representing this other. Queer theory in the context of adoptees remains a theoretical perspective from which to challenge the normative. In this case, the normative remains Asian American, without the inclusion of adoptees who represent the other, challenging what it means to be both Asian and American. I really like this quote by Tobias Stupinet, a scholar from Sweden. He says, adopted Koreans can be likened to ethnic drags and cross-dressers, transvestites, or even transsexuals, or the transgendered who are troubling, mocking, and parodying supposedly fixed racial, ethnic, and national identities of belonging. And from there I'm looking at how Butler's performativity theory, which is rooted in queer theory, is linked to discursive subject formation. Performativity is the act, recognizing the power of language and subsequently the act of doing. In this context, I find the adoptee performs whiteness, because that's the only act she knows. In this context, the adoptee is an individual with a Western name living in a white family, And but the adoptee, the outsider, mimics this whiteness because she doesn't have any other experiences to draw upon except for life as a Westerner. What prevents the adoptee from gaining full Western white subjectivity is the adoptee's non-white, subsequently marked body, resulting in what Butler considers a performative misfire. The adoptee represents what Butler describes as an ideal that no one can embody, as a parody of whiteness fails in its mimicry. The adoptee identity is produced through discursive reimaginings into the continued production of whiteness, as the adoptee seeks what has been lost between the outside, her physical ethnic appearance, and the inside, her Western outlook and experiences. I draw upon Baba's work on hybridity to further the understanding of mimicry, noting that mimicry is rooted in the desire for forms and recognize other that is almost the same, but not quite. I'm aware of the fact that hybridity has been linked to post-colonialism and colonization, but I contend the adoptee is a colonized body, as she left the agency and free choice in her forced migration to the West. In the history of adoption, the adoptee may be forcibly removed or kidnapped from her homeland. Consequently, the adoptee is the hybrid through the ambivalence and slippages between the colonizer and the colonial subject. In this case, the adoptive Western white culture and the adoptee's Asian homeland respectively. The hybrid exists in what Baba describes as the third space, the space of ambivalence that is both in between and neither nor sameness and otherness, constantly undergoing transformation. Located in a state of transition and blurred boundaries, the adoptee's borderlands are a way in which the hybrid subverts from the inside out dominant culture through the friction between sameness and otherness as inhabited by the third space. I want to draw upon the first quote that I have up there. It's at Katapalooza, which stands for Korean American Adoptees. And they're using this term on their t-shirts called stealth Asian. And that draws upon and notes the whole notion of colorblindness. Adoptees are existing where, you know, their parents are telling them they're like everybody else, they're American, and not necessarily recognizing that they have a race. By de-racializing them, it just encourages this adoptee to perform what? White. When you look at these statistics, as adults, although 10% only view themselves as American and European, you know, this is on par as being viewed as Asian Korean almost, and being viewed as Caucasian. The term South Asian embraces the borderland identity which is given to inter-country adoptees from the projected stereotypes of others. Consequently, I find subject formation of the female adoptee is analogous to the experience of female Asian Americans, and that both are positioned as marginal subjects in Western eyes. The adoptee remains disenfranchised for her performative misfire and that she can never be truly white, while the Asian American, female Asian American exists in the borderlands under the trope of professional foreigner. However, in addition to her failure to be white, the adoptee also finds herself at the periphery because she is also of Asian descent when looking at dominant discourse. So even though there is a distinct linkage between the adoptee and Asian American identity, an incommensurability exists in the reconciliation of the performed whiteness of adoptees and the unauthentic Asian experience against the societal construction of the authentic Asian experience, which is what forms Asian American counter-discourse. Considered foreign in both Western and Asian eyes, the adoptee is never fully accepted. I'm basically using post-colonial and queer theory to sort of start the beginnings of the conversation about where we locate the adoptee experience. She can never be fully viewed as white, for obvious reasons. But yet, in Asian American discourse, a lot of the experiences drawn upon as we talk about what it means to be Asian American has a lot to do with the struggles of our parents and our forefathers. Although they have the same history and the same struggles now, by the way society views them, they can't say, well, my father was an immigrant and came over to this country, or my mother, or my grandmother. So I hope I can start a conversation here for us to all think about where the adoptee is situated. Thank you.
thank you so much. For sure, you know, I am listening. This is the new multicultural, new America we are talking about. And it is a question about where do we place Asian American women in this changing demographics, in the new demographics. So I'm very happy to introduce our last speaker, Dr. Virginia Tong, who is a professor in School of Education at Hunter College. And her work is on social cultural linguistics, on education. And I'm very happy that she has agreed to present here about the Chinese youth and the education system and what kind of experiences they go through. Here is Dr. Virginia Tong. Just in a moment, as soon as we set up the PowerPoint, right?
Yeah, thank you.
See.
Maybe
you want to introduce
that gentleman. That's Ricardo Lewis, one of my graduate students in our MA People program, and Ebony Chu Brown, who is also a graduate student in our program, both at Hunter College. So
thank
you very much for helping me. Well, I'm going to be really brief, and I can't tell you how excited I am to be here. Sharing my ideas with you is only one way of my validating some of my feelings, and please, your input and your feedback would be greatly appreciated. I wanted to recognize my very, very favorite mentor, Dr. Betty Solma. Without her work, I would never have started my journey, my very long and I hope continued journey. Today, I can only give you a snapshot of a third study that I conducted. And it's really just merely a snapshot, and it's a very brief PowerPoint, I must tell you. But I hope that each panel will present you with major ideas. That's the first panel. That's just the introduction. That's the title. And I say sociocultural because I think the aspects of acculturation are not just language, but social and cultural. Yeah, I mean, acculturation sometimes is measured by language production, but really it's how well do our young Chinese youth interact with the main society that really captures the success of their acculturation. So, and the other part of this is silent voices. This is a part of my research that I've never presented on, and I'm really, really thrilled that I can, because I think our Chinese youth, because they're so wonderful and so quiet, although Linda may not think that they're that quiet. Linda is a colleague of mine from Hunter. Chinese immigrant youth don't articulate their ideas. And I was fortunate enough to I interviewed about 100 students, and I pulled some of the major questions that they asked of me about their lives in America, and I'll unfold the questions as we go through them. I will tell you, I am very pleased that Dr. Kendall defined this panel as a new demographic, where I'm not presenting hard data, but I am presenting to you a perspective on young female youth, Chinese youth. And the questions that come out of this study really were more articulated from the young girl in my cohort of 100 students. So that's why I say that they're silent voices. And let's just go through it. There's a concept that's out there called Generation 1.5, and I think that these youth are really in that age range simply because they are not really part of America, and they are not first generation who've come here as their parents did, and they weren't born here as second generation. They're the group in the middle, so that's 1.5. They've come from China, mostly well-formed in terms of who they are, what they feel are the important elements of who they are as an identity. So there are certain characteristics, 12 to 18 years old, not part of first generation, their parents, not part of second generation who were born here, but they're that middle group. And I think the critical piece here is, and it's problematic for them, is that there's a conflict, there's a tension that occurs because they're neither fish nor fowl. They're not American and they're not Chinese. And they're not like their parents, and yet they are very much like their parents. So there are a lot of things going on in that body, in that mind, that really causes a lot of frustration. Unspoken frustration, though. And that's what I think, that's why I call it the silent voice. This is actually, every time I look at them, I get goosebumps because these are students that I actually had in my study. That's their ESL teacher, and you can see that's their ESL classroom. Just in a snapshot, they are from China. The statistics, 103 students. Most of them came from China. They live with their parents, although they live with others too, grandparents, aunts, uncles, cousins. They range in age. They're a little bit older, 16 to 19 years old. Putonghua is their primary language, although they speak Cantonese and Hokkienese as well. But Putonghua is their major. They've been in this country, and I deliberately captured a group that was here for a very short period of time, 1 to 3 years, because I think that's where the friction or the their attitudes, their well-being, the sense of well-being really develops during those critical 3 years. Now, their prior schooling, as you can imagine, if you know the history of the suburban settings, they might not have access to a lot of education, but interestingly enough, even though they're a little bit older, they did still have some education. So I really felt good about that the government is making education more accessible to the groups who live in the different regions, whether it be in, anyway. This is a 10th and 11th grade mixture group. What I also want to share with you is that I believe that there's a changing voice out there where women are becoming more, female students are becoming more expressive about what they want to know. The boys, the young men, are a little bit quiet because of this notion of self-esteem and the need to project a strong male position, so they don't really articulate their concerns. But the girls did, or the young women did. I don't have a full picture of this class because it was just too big to put, and Ricky and I had a little bit of a problem trying to fit in that picture. But of the entire class, these are the only girls in the class. The rest of them were boys. So as you can imagine, the one child and the son first regulation really held true here because the girls are underrepresented. They might not be in school for a variety of reasons. Perhaps the parents didn't encourage them to go to school. They encouraged the boys as a pattern, as there is a pattern. They're so precious. I want to hug each and one of them. But the girls though were very, very sharp. When they gave an answer, they gave the right answer. And when they spoke well. And I was really happy for them. I was really proud of them. I'm a teacher at heart, so I really, really, I really look proud of the kids. The girls, and interestingly, I think this is from Dr. Song's work earlier today. In terms of statistics, I don't want to get into the questions just yet. Asian American women by level of education, not high school grads, 16%. High school grads, still only 38%. That's pretty low. So I think our girls, while for whatever reason they don't complete their education or perhaps they don't attend, the numbers are low. And we need to really look at that. Because it's a different paradigm. There's a need for girls to be obviously more represented and participants of education. Be that as it may, though, these girls were, as I said, they were quite expressive, and that's only a snapshot of a small 1/10 of the total population that I actually interviewed. What do they want to know? Some of their questions. They want to know what Americans think about. So embedded in that is a quality of values, attitudes, and beliefs. What drives the behavior of Americans? just posing the question. I'm not even trying to interpret why they're asking it. Who and how do they make friends? This says to me that their peer groups are very important to them. And Betty, I know in your research you talk about youngsters growing up in New York City, but I wonder how different they are compared to who you study and who this group is now. These students also wanted to know how holidays are celebrated. Birthdays, Christmas, Valentine's Day. And of course, Thanksgiving. They wanted to know why these holidays were so important. Because it's getting at the heart of the issue of what are the values that drive the American culture. Because the more they know the values of the American culture, you can imagine, the more that they can interpret and participate and make decisions not to participate, because they don't necessarily participate in everything that they see. They're very critical thinkers. They might not express it, but they are. And then you kind of delve a little bit into pop culture. What shows, movies, movie stars, singers, do they like? I mean, you can see the teenagers, right? So that makes a lot of sense. So what this is telling me is that they're identifying with the American culture, but they're identifying with their peers. What do their peers like? So it makes them more like their peers, so they don't stick out like outsiders, they're not marginalized. Okay. How do they hang out? How do Americans hang out? Do they go to the movies? What do? Do they go to the park? Implications for their future behavior, Chinese students. Can I have the watch? I'll keep an eye on the time. What do Americans mean by being free? I was really surprised to get this question that they would ask me that. What is it telling me about what they feel about being free in their country, not being free or feeling free? Or has the notion of freedom changed in their country? I was in China 2 years ago, and a year ago, and I interviewed some college students, and interestingly, they want to stay in China. They're very hopeful. So China's changing, even by the time I collected this, which was 3 years ago, to now. And the last question, what is their communication style? That's pretty easy. Networking, eventual success in business, making small talk, making conversations with others in their school. Okay? I kind of have the hook here. So what does it mean? Values, friends, lifestyles, pop culture, communication, all major considerations. Okay? What are the implications? As I said, Generation 1.5 students are very different from their parents, but they're very curious about American life. That's not because they necessarily want to stay here, but they want to control it, manipulate it, right? In my research, roughly 50% said they believe they can succeed in America, 50% said they could succeed in their country. So that needs to be sifted out a little bit more, but they do want to participate. They want to find ways to balance their primary, that's their home, and their American culture. This cross-cultural tension is an intangible. It's not abstract. It's certainly intangible. And obviously, who they are now is an amalgamation of their primary and American culture. For me, I felt very hopeful talking to them. They're willing to engage in changes. They see new horizons. They're not afraid to take it on. But it seems that more boys are going to college than girls, although I don't have statistics on college participation. So thank you very much.
For individual or for all of them.
I just wanted to start by making three observations. As I was listening to the speakers and also talking to them earlier and communicating with them on email about their work, I'm struck by the thought, what does it mean to be Asian American? And what is Asian America? When we talk about that, I'm talking about a very broad topic here, but it comes to that. You know, what do we mean by Asian America? Where does Asia meet? You know, Asia meets America. You know, because we are talking of populations, you know, like 1.5 generations, right, who are coming here. We are talking about populations who have been here for some time, and also the way that they are coming here, and, you know, whether they have roots here or not, what kind of roots do they have. We are talking about those kind of realities and the identities. And I was also struck by the fact that I think many of us here are on campuses, on university campuses, and we are seeing these populations among our students. And even if we are not on university campuses, we are seeing these populations in our communities. We are seeing all these things happen. Actually, very real. You know, when I was listening, I was actually thinking of my students, so many of them, and these faces, not just of Asian Americans, but also of other students, and how these cross-cultural identities are actually the reality of today. So we also have to think about CUNY as an urban commuter campus and our communities and how these communities are coming into, are reflected in our student population on different campuses. And also, lastly, I just want to mention that for me, it is a question about relationship between education, higher education, particularly for some of us, and gender and ethnicity and race as such, because, I mean, these issues about, do we engage the students in some of these debates about gender empowerment, about education, education as a way to empower students, not only in terms of knowing who Asian Americans are, but what kind of challenges and issues they face in terms of their identity. And to me, that is a field that Asian American studies is. You know, when we ask these questions and we raise these issues and we engage the communities as well, students and our communities in these debates. So I just wanted to mention that, and I hope that some of the points that are mentioned by the speakers have made you think about some of those things. But also, I'm sure you have questions and comments. So with that, I'm going to take some questions. If you could say your name, please, and maybe just one line affiliation and be brief. I really appreciate that, so that we can have more, as many people as possible in this time that we have. Okay, so I'm not going to introduce you.
Hi, I'm Tricia Lin. I teach women's studies and direct women's studies program. But today is more like coming home. I was at CUNY for 10 years, teaching English and ethnic studies at Borough Manhattan Community College. I just want to thank all three speakers, but my question is particularly directed at the CUNY. I want to thank you for a very, very rich study. It's you know, I think I, granted, the study of adoptees, a sort of racial, transracial category, has yet to be further explored, but I have not yet seen, or at least in my sort of reading, very limited reading, I have not come across people daringly bringing queer and post-colonial theories. To you, I actually want to, question is very simple, because the other two speakers sort of pointed to the future, changes in new horizons, and you made a statement that adoptees are sort of bodies colonized, but I see the decolonization there. So I would like to hear from you more about that sort of movement of the decolonizing the colonized, inter-country adoptees.
Well, I think when you look at inter-country adoptees as sort of colonized bodies, because they don't have the choice when they move from one country or another, there has been a lot of talk amongst at least specialists that look at Korean international adoption. Thank you. Likening inter-country adoption to slave trade and the buying and selling of bodies and the movement of bodies on the same sort of route. So I think for us to move forward, we're also going to have to think of the United States, what it means to have these transracial placements as more babies are being brought over from Africa. Mm-hmm. I mean, what does that mean for us? Because, you know, in the 1970s, the National Black Social Workers came out against transracial placements of black babies and white families. So I think, you know, before talking about decolonization and all of that, we need to sort of figure out where we stand on transracial placements in general. You can't just say domestic black babies are somehow very much different than African children being adopted into white families.
Can I just quickly say, do you see a sort of movement sort of within Asian America, or say the transnational adoptees coming together, articulating?
Yes. There actually are. Last year was one of the major international gatherings in Seoul of internationally adopted Koreans. There's also many different adoptee associations. There's AKA in New York, which is an organization for adoptive Koreans. So there is a lot going on up there.
Okay, and next question. And say, if any of you want to, this question was for me, but if any of you want to jump in, please let me know. Okay, so the next question or comment. Anything. It doesn't have to be about the presentation. If you feel you have something to add. Betty? we look towards you.
I'm looking at Virginia, and I was looking to see what she was going to say about Asian American youth and their sociocultural, what is it, heritage or whatever.
The social cultural questions.
Mm-hmm. And you just narrowed it down to the 1.5 generation of people, and they were in the high school age. In the high school, I was looking to see if there was something more broader, because I think we have a lot of those, and their attitudes are totally different from, you know, the Asian traditional attitudes. I was looking to see some of that. Are you going to go further into that?
well, this study actually has been concluded. That's certainly another research grant. I'm completing a study on acculturation of these kids. Through the lens of teachers. I'm concerned with what happens with this generation 1.5, not their attitudes, but why they're left out of the picture sometimes. Why they fall through the cracks. And interviewing them would be really a good idea, but they don't give me the information. They don't know how to articulate what's in their heart and on their minds. I think it's a possible another research grant to look at counselors and get from counselors and other agencies what's really troubling these youth. I will definitely want to interview more youth, definitely.
Well, I have another question, because I belong to another organization called the Committee of 100, and we did a survey. And we asked a lot of the Asian American, Chinese Americans, young people, what their thoughts were. And one question we asked was, who are your role models? And guess who they were? Because I was very surprised. They were mainly celebrities and sports people. And I said, you know, traditionally in Asian tradition, these are not the people that we look up to. In fact, they are looked down upon. And yet, here they were, looking up to celebrities and to sports people, which is what American values are. They look up to celebrities and sports heroes. And the other question that was asked is, we asked them, have you ever experienced discrimination? A lot of them, more than half, said no. And I said, well, that's unusual, because, I mean, when we were growing up, we experienced a lot of it. So, I mean, how are the younger generation changing? And that's what I was looking to Virginia to tell me. She needs another grant.
But there was one question that they asked, which was, who are the favorite movie stars? It's sort of in the pop culture way, movie stars, singers, and so on. So they are, it's interesting, because of the exposure of the American culture, how can they not take on some of the quote-unquote American values, but what is American? Is it only American or is it European?
Virginia, because, you know, when I was listening to Benny, and I just want to add one thing here, it's not part of the presentations, but once I gave my students an assignment to interview people, and these were, and I asked them, I said, you know, you can give names, assign names, because you're not going to report the real names of people, right? So what they did is, it was a total shock to me. The South Asian students in the class, right, they assigned names of all the Bollywood stars. And I was like reading these papers, and this is not even in America in that sense. You know, it's the transnational, the global, you know, this whole thing. And these are South Asians who have grown up here in the United States of America. Some of them are US born, some of them are 1.5, some of them are immigrants, whatever. But they were giving names of all these movie stars, like Aishwarya Rai and Shah Rukh Khan and all. And I'm like, this is, you know, those are the names that came to them. It was not, you know, John and this and that, or you know, Mary. All these names. And I mean, part of me was laughing. When I was reading this, and I think, what is going on here, you know? And so talking about role models, yeah, and the movie stars and all these things, but also if there's a kind of, in a strange way, I'm saying, it's when we say global, you know, there's a lot of things going on. Everything is not global in the same way. But to some extent it's global, and to some extent it's very ethnic, particular, specific also. So all these things are happening at the same time. You know, it's America, but also it is like, you know, what part of America are we talking about?
Well, what does this mean?
Exactly what it means. And you talk about names. I took out of the 100, I think nearly 50% of the students took on boys and girls. Took on American names. That's interesting. Cher was one. I was waiting for Madonna. But it's interesting. And I asked them why, and they said one is because they like the sound of the name, but also they feel that their American teachers can't remember their Chinese name.
Right.
So really, to get at what you want, Betty, it's I think you probably need, you're talking about what is their identity now and how is it defined. I think it's got to be defined by several things, by the students themselves, and by people outside, like counselors, who can articulate what they think students are thinking. And then correlate the two somehow. Take the two bodies of knowledge and correlate and see how valid, you know, the information is.
Christina Wazat from Brooklyn College. Yesterday we had a leadership awards luncheon, and one of the MCs is Chinese, and we call her Jessica, but that's not her real name. And she said because we don't, it's a beautiful name, and we butcher it. And she's tired of hearing people make it sound so ugly when it's such a beautiful name. So for a while she didn't say Jessica, but she got so tired of hearing people say, you know, her name wrong that she just stuck with Jessica. It was interesting to hear that side of it as well.
They really do have presence of mind, but they don't have a venue to articulate their concern. And I think you're right, Betty, I should look into another grant.
We should wrap up soon. I don't know, Frank, do you have an idea how much time?
Yeah, I think we should wrap up.
Now?
Yeah.
Okay, but can I give the speakers, not final word, but, you know, if you want to say something about the discussion today, and then we'll wrap up.
When we talk about adoption, I also think it's very much akin to talking about what it means to be mixed race. And I just wanted to end on that note because, you know, when you talk about what it means to be a hybrid, you're directly talking about what it means to be mixed race. And that's something we can't forget. I think a lot of people, when they see an adoptee who's Asian, they're like, oh, they must be Asian. And they must just, there's all these assumptions that go along with it, even by other Asian Americans. So that's something everybody needs to be cognizant about.
In sort of making the comparison between transnational adoption and slave trade, that was really interesting to me, because I think it's important to think about how slaves did physical work to sustain the U.S., whereas these kinds of movements can do ideological work to sustain certain movements. Think about the nature of the U.S., and that's, I think, an important thing to think about.
I just want to probably continue the last few minutes of our conversation. I think that there's definitely a change in demographics where I think Chinese women will have more of a voice in America than they've ever had.
You mean the Asian American women also or not?
Oh, I can't say because I was very
specific. Yeah, but if you're looking on Asian American women, then I'm wondering if you do.
I can't only because, okay. I mean, I would like to.
Okay.
But I can say that I think Chinese women will redefine their identity in America. In ways that they never knew how the law could work for them. We talk about abuse and how they can really rely upon those services. So I think there's a change in demographic in that way.
So thank you so much for coming. And I think there's an event just starting, right? In a few minutes.
Right, we have Nina Alexander's reading and wine and cheese.
Yes.
Wine and cheese upstairs.
Right, and we can continue these conversations informally, I'm sure, right? In this conference and beyond. Thank you so much for coming.